Welcome to Bobby Osinski's Inner Circle. I'm Bobby Osinski, and this is a show all about music, music production, and the music business. My guest this week is Paul Hubert, Jim Rondinelli, and J.J. Johnston from Immersion Networks. But first of all, who do you think the biggest streaming songwriters are? Well, in some cases you might not be surprised, in other cases you definitely will be. A company called Blocker looked at the charts of Spotify, Apple Music, Amazon Music, and YouTube, and rated each song by its popularity and by the time that it spent on the chart. So they looked at each platform's flagship chart, like Spotify's Global Top 200, Apple's Global Top 100, Amazon Music's Top 200, and YouTube's Top 100 Global Weekly charts. What they found out was kind of interesting. First of all, the top 10 songwriters are Tones and I, Roddy Ricch, Finneas O'Connell, Drake, Lil Baby, Billie Eilish, Oz, Ed Sheeran, Louis Capaldi, and Pop Smoke. Tones and I is really curious, but when you look at the fact that the song racked up over 2.2 billion plays just on Spotify, while its official YouTube video has over 1.6 billion views, I find it even more curious the fact that it's not a dance song, even though it's called Dance Monkey. Now, if we look at the top 10 non-artist songwriters, here's what we find. Number one is Finneas O'Connell, who is brother and producer for Billie Eilish. Number two is Oz, 30 Rock, Louis Bell, Pooh Bear, Thomas Hull, Max Martin, kind of expect him to be there, Ross Portero, Frank Dukes, and Oscar Halter. Now, where it really gets interesting is when we go to the YouTube-only songwriter charts. The top five songwriters on YouTube last year were Badshah, Tones and I, S. Tommen, Drake, and Tony Kakkar. Now, three of those are Indian. If we look at the top five non-artist songwriters on YouTube, we find S. Tommen, Kunal Verma, Oz, Ashish Verma, and Braulio F.P. Acosta. Again, three of the top five are Indian. What this is showing us is that Indian pop music is really coming on strong, even though it's kind of under the radar. When we think of Asian pop music, we naturally think of K-pop, but this is coming on strong because it's so big right now on YouTube. Now, if we take this yet another step and we look and see which streaming platforms have the greatest market share, Spotify by far is the biggest with 32%. Then we get Apple Music at 16%, Amazon at 13%, Tencent, the giant Chinese streaming service, at 13%. And then we get Google, which is basically YouTube, at 8%. What we don't see here is the fact that YouTube is coming on super strong. And the fact of the matter is, it's becoming very big with younger audiences all around the world. The thinking is that YouTube music is becoming to Gen Z what Spotify was to millennials about a half decade ago. So if you look beneath the surface, the streaming landscape is really changing, although you wouldn't know it by what you hear in the media, by what you read, but we're seeing trends that show that things could be different very soon. If you have any questions or comments, you can send them to questions@bobbyosinski.com. Don't forget about my Music Mixing Primer and 101 Mixing Tricks programs that will help take your mixes to the next level. Go to bobbyosinskicourses.com to learn more. Now, if you're a keyboard player or a producer, I'm sure you used an electronic piano patch on a synthesizer somewhere, but one of the main electronic pianos has always been the Fender Rhodes. The fact of the matter is you can't buy a new one. They've been out of production for a while. Until now, a new English company called Rhodes Music Group Limited is going to start production again. Now, the Rhodes electric piano has a long, long history that most people are not aware of. Harold Rhodes actually made his first piano in 1942, and he called it the pre-piano, and it was to accompany his teaching method for soldiers that were recovering from injuries during World War II. Now, Harold's electric piano kept on getting better and better, and in 1959, he went into a joint venture with Leo Fender. But Leo really didn't like the higher sounds of the electric piano, so he did a 53-note model, which they called the Fender keyboard bass, and of course that was made very famous as the low end of the Doors and all their hits. So the Fender Rhodes also had a unique look with a fiberglass top, but actually these were leftovers from a boat manufacturer. Leo Fender was notoriously cheap, and he just wanted to save money everywhere, so he got this boat manufacturer to give him all his extras. So that's why some are black, and some are red, and some are purple, and it wasn't because people ordered them that way, it's just because that's what they had. The sustain pedal was from a Rogers hi-hat stand. Fender was bought by CBS in 1965, and it wasn't long after where the first 73-note model was actually introduced. Then along the way, there were student instructor models for keyboard labs. An 88-note model came out in 1981. In 1983, though, Fender was bought from CBS by a team of executives led by William Schultz, who then closed the factory in 1985 and sold the Rhodes brand to Roland in 1987. Harold Rhodes hated the Roland pianos, and he had no input on them. So in 1997, he managed to reacquire the Rhodes brand. But he was in poor health and then passed away in the year 2000. In 2007, a reformed Rhodes Music Corporation tried to introduce the reproduction of the original. Now we're going to see this brand new Rhodes company try it again. The only problem is these are expensive to produce and expensive to sell. They're really heavy because they're about 130 pounds or so, which is pretty much impractical for touring. However, if you're a keyboard player, you know about how cool these can be, especially one that's really tweaked out. And also, if you're a keyboard player, you know that you couldn't just take a stock Rhodes piano and make it work. You needed the action tuned up a little bit. So we'll see what happens with this brand new version that's coming out. Aficionados are looking forward to it, I guarantee. My guests this week are President and Founder Paul Hubert, CEO Jim Rondinelli, and Chief Scientist J.J. Johnston from the 3D mixing platform Immersion Networks. The company's innovative MixCubed software allows anyone to upload tracks and mix them in a three-dimensional environment. These mixes can then be appreciated without any kind of special hardware and distributed through streaming services. The credentials of my guests are indeed impressive. Paul worked alongside Steve Jobs at Apple, installing the first Macs at Prince's Paisley Park Studios and creating audio formats that liberated the potential of satellite radio. Jim has recorded and produced more than 100 album projects and received gold and platinum awards for his work with Matthew Sweet, Wilco, Weezer, and Everclear, but he has a long history in music tech with Warner Chappell Music, Slacker, and RDO, among others. JJ is an authority on human perception and audio signal processing, having worked for 25 years at Bell Labs, where he helped develop the MP3 and AAC codecs. During the interview, we spoke about the most important speaker in a multi-speaker setup, the limitations of modern LP-style production, developing a streaming service way before one existed commercially, how perceptual codecs were created, and much more. I spoke with the group via Zoom from their office in Redmond, Washington. I would love to actually get into it with each and every one of you, but I don't think we have the time. So let's just go back to how Immersion Networks started.
I think that is a great setup for Paul and JJ.
Yeah, sure. So Immersion Networks started, a summary of both JJ and I's life work coming into building a platform. Around 2015, we got started on the project, and we've been in this field for a long time, and together we decided that it was time to build a spatial audio platform that should be maybe the last thing we really should need. Do everything that audio, could capture in a certain way, distribute a certain way, and also, experience it as a consumer is the best way that it could be intended. And it's a pretty ambitious project. We we got started building the team in 2015 and the facilities to do all the testing and everything. But again, it's, you know, JJ and I had been working together for many years and really enjoyed working on projects, but this was a very ambitious one.
Before we go there here, so you were working on the seeds of this prior to Immersion Networks, I take it?
Yeah, ultimately, I've been on this journey since I started in audio, really in my early 20s. And it's always been my dream to be able to capture something that's live, something that feels real, and, you know, distribute it all the way down to, or bottle that experience and share it with fans or consumers or, you know, anybody that's interested in audio. And, you know, it's taking a lot of time to get to where technology can meet that. And luckily, we've, you know, found ourselves at a really interesting window where everyone has supercomputers in their pockets. They have, you know, things, they have so much computation power around that we can, do amazing things with very little, you know, interaction from other things.
I can put in a few words.
Sure.
I started out when I was a kid. I mean, we're talking about way before college, doing sound for bands and stuff like that. I got my EE degree and another EE degree and went to Bell Labs, where they were just developing the whole signal processing field. And I wound up working in acoustics research for people that were doing signal processing and acoustics and hearing research. So that's my background. How I got to this point is at AT&T, I contributed a whole bunch of stuff to the MP3 standard and even more to the AAC standard. Then AT&T basically exploded as a company. I came out here, worked for the other Evil Empire for a few years in their audio division. Went from there to a company Paul was running called Immersion, Neural Audio. And after that sold, I left there and started working here. My motivation technically is that the perceptual aspects have been ignored. Then I mentioned ignored and then ignored some more. When you have stereo, we're still using no delay pan pots. You will hear some of the people claim, if you have delay, it won't work right. Well, actually, the only way it works right is with delay. That means loudspeakers, headphones, I don't care what you're doing. If you want to get a stereo image that actually stays put in one place, you need to handle delay aspects. You also have to handle other acoustic aspects, even if you're not talking about headphones. If you're talking about headphones, you need to handle even more aspects, including basically head acoustics, as well as room acoustics, concert hall acoustics, etc. And none of this is all that hard to do, but it requires completely new production from the ground up. And the tool we're talking about is the tool that basically is building that from the ground up. It's not a pan pot. It's not a reverb. It is a complete acoustic simulation that's integrated with head acoustics. And although that sounds incredibly complicated, once you figure out how to do it, it's pretty much a large CPU running fast. But, well, I'll give you an idea. When I did the first perceptual codec called PXFM at Bell Labs in like 1984, it ran in about four times real time on the fastest computer available, which was called an Alliant FX80, which was 160 megaflops. It was less than that MIPS. Nowadays, you know, I think my watch does that nowadays. So all of this power has not been used. And so we're using some of the computing power now to actually do things that needed to be done a long time ago, but weren't happening.
Now, there are other companies that do some of what you're talking about, but I take it that your approach is different.
Well, my approach is from the point of view of perception. You have to look at what you hear, say, in a concert hall or a concert or a rock concert or whatever, and you have to figure out what are the actual audible cues. That's where all the hearing comes in. And so everything is built backwards from how to get the cues into your ears. I don't know if you've ever seen my old talk on perceptual audio coding. It goes back all the way to 1989. But it makes the point that a perceptual audio coder, if you measure the signal-to-noise ratio, say, of AAC, it will be worse than the actual best high signal, the best signal-to-noise ratio you could get from a codec, but it will sound enormously better. The same, this because when you put the noise where you can't hear it, and you remove things that you couldn't hear, that makes the signal-to-noise worse. Now, for what we're doing, we're not actually adding noise, but we're adding the actual cues that give you a sense of like distance, externalization, localization. Some pieces of that are pretty well known. To my knowledge, all the tools that are out there don't integrate them properly.
That's what I was getting at, actually, that there are other companies that kind of sniff around the edges of this.
But they don't integrate them all properly into one thing. So when you get one cue that says it's from over there and another cue that says it's from over there, your brain basically goes, huh? I mean, it might even be a useful sound effect, but it's not usually what people are trying to achieve. I mean, we've seen some evidence of this use of perception all the way back with people doing delay panning with two tape recorders and stuff. But it's very, then it was very hard to manage. Now you can take it, you can go onto our website, take a finger and go, oh, let's move it over there. Sorry, you can't see where my finger is, but you follow what I'm saying.
Yeah.
Actually, that's a great, let me just take a quick pause for a question. Bobby, have you had a chance to upload any tracks to the mix engine? Have you had a chance to play with it at all?
No, I haven't done that. But what I have done is listen to the demos, which were really impressive.
Can't wait for you to upload some tracks and kick the tires and play with it yourself.
Yeah, the challenge is you're still listening to the demos through YouTube's codec, and you know you're losing something. But we want to make sure it can make it through. But there's a lot of extra cues in there to make sure that it still works on even not ideal situations. But when you hear it offline, you know, off the website, you're not hearing any lossy compression in there. So it makes a big difference.
Let me take it back to sort of record producer speak, right? So it sometimes when we were making records, we had sort of core realities or ground rules that we would establish for making the records that for better or for worse, sometimes we just have a random creative limitation that we'd instruct on something but would inform our approach. Ours is a little different here. We don't put creative limitations on anybody, but we had some key principles that we wanted to adhere to. We wanted to come up with a product and an output that could be experienced by anybody on the hardware that they already own, and they could also be experienced over the relatively crude but still present in market codecs that are currently in use by the major media streaming services. And we've accomplished that with all of this stuff. And we're not asking you to buy hardware to experience it. The biggest use case for music these days is on headphones. Our headphone experience is indistinguishable from a properly set up speaker experience when you have, the emphasis on both properly set up. But most importantly, headphones weren't an afterthought. We didn't start out with 30 speakers in a room, then try to figure out what we had to do to get it down to two channels. We started with what's the real world case and what do we have to do to have people perceive it.
The big limitation with Atmos and with the other immersive systems is the fact that you need all those speakers. And even if you have the integrated ones, it's still, you need multiple speakers, which has been the downfall from, the 5.1 days.
Oh, from Quad. Let's go back to Peter Shriver's Quad. I mean, 1936 or whatever it was, right?
Well, I will make a point about Quad. Quad was missing stuff that was discovered in 1933, which is if you're going to add a third speaker, it has to be the center speaker.
Yeah.
The center speaker is absolutely the most important in a three-speaker system. We proved that back at AT&T when I did some, if you saw some stuff called perceptual sound field reconstruction, if you got, you can find it back on the AES website. AT&T went nowhere with it, but that's the story of my life. But basically this goes back to Fletcher and Snow, or sorry, Steinberg and Snow, and working under Fletcher in 1933. You need the center speaker. It has to do with the acoustics of the head, believe it or not. And that's one of the things that are missing. But another point I want to make is that modern production is still limited in a lot of ways by what I would call LP thinking. LPs are persnickety things to produce. There's no question about it. So what you have is you have things like monoed bass, and you tend to avoid time delays because it makes it difficult to cut the record. Now, if you're building an LP, that's the way to do it because you actually want it to work. But you don't need to do that in digital. Instead, the advantage they've taken of digital is to turn the gain up to 12. You know, we're no longer at 11, we're at 12. I've got lots of statistics on modern tracks, and it's pretty breathtaking when a track has almost the same peak to RMS ratio as a square wave.
You know, it's funny. I am within walking distance of two major mastering studios, and they're my friends. And when I have time, I like to go hang out. I like mastering engineers, and I like to see what they're working on. And the material that they get in is just amazing. I mean, it's basically two boards, top and bottom.
Yeah.
And what's even worse is the fact that there's overs all over the place. And at first, they were freaked out about it. And then it got to the point where it's like, well, we don't even care anymore because they don't. Nobody even mentions it. So that's where we're at.
And Bobby, the joke about that is that when you reconstruct filters as part of the transcoding process and the delivery mechanism of any streaming service, you're adding gain. So you think you have overs now, wait till they come out of the back end of Spotify supply chain.
Yeah.
Well, and just to get to something else, the thing that a lot of people don't look at is intersample overs. And when you look at intersample overs, a friend of mine and I have tested a lot of DACs and a lot of otherwise well-known DACs. I'm not going to name any brands or anything, but a lot of others, they're otherwise very well, but just explode on intersample. They just do. I can only describe it as stuff. You would have to go into the chip and figure out why it did that to even explain it. But what it isn't doing is reproducing a waveform.
Wow.
Sometimes this will persist for five or six samples after the end of the over too. I mean, so this is a problem, but the reason I was mentioning though the intersample overs is that's what they used digital for. They haven't used digital for doing things like reproducing bass like it actually happens in a listening room, especially a concert hall. Concert halls being very wide, if you think about it, you have lots of modes going back and forth across. Guess what? That's part of the whole thing. This sounds like a big room. I notice if you listen to a 5.1 system, somehow it always feels tight, yes?
Mm, yeah.
That's because it's a .1. Again, back at AT&T, I had a wonderful demo of this. What it did is I could play the same thing, mono, stereo, or 5-channel captured with that microphone we were using then. If I played it mono or stereo, it was horribly boomy. And we're talking about, just so it's clear, we're talking about the same spectrum. We're not changing the signal here. We're just changing the number of signals, the number of speakers it's reproduced through. When you turn on all five channels, suddenly now the boom is around you and you can hear the stuff in front and it sounds like a hall.
Doesn't Atmos take that into consideration though?
With .4? The answer to that is complicated, but without a rendering system at the far end that I'm not aware exists, it's really hard.
Okay.
I mean, if you're doing this with full range loudspeakers and at least five of them, you're good. But there is coherence involved between, I mean, people talk about you can't localize below 90 hertz. This is true. However, you can detect spatial effects down to 40 hertz.
Hmm. Okay.
And that's where the problem comes in. And now a lot of these mini satellite speakers cross over to 110 hertz. Which is just too high, end of sentence.
Yeah, yeah. I know you guys have built some hardware as well. I take it it's hardware for your own internal testing, or is this something that's going to be a product?
So we like to talk about products as they're ready for market. And at any point in time, I mean, if you walk through this, there's any number of experiments and designs and things that we developed here, sometimes for our own internal use with no intentions of commercializing it, and sometimes as prototypes and market tests for the future. So what we are focusing on now is the platform that we've made for immersive audio, which is entirely cloud-based and offers some opportunities to do things in the cloud that you just can't do with any other system. For example, we suspend any notion of how many cores are available at any point in time. You need 8,000 cores at the same time for your mix? No problem. We do it.
Bill you, maybe, but that's a different issue.
Yes.
Well, let's go there for a second. So the one thing I don't get is how you're going to monetize this.
It's pretty easy. So from our perspective, MixCubed is the beginning of a platform. It's the beginning of movement. It's the beginning of a community. And it's the beginning of an experience. We give people the opportunity to create fully bespoke next generation audio experiences for an introductory price of $9.99 a month, which makes it extensible to creators of all stripes and sizes, whether it's somebody working on a multi-platinum release, or somebody who's working on a TikTok video who wants to have something that has audio that's differentiated from the rest of the world. Now, over time, we'll be introducing additional feature sets and capabilities that'll come with premium prices. But back to the core aesthetic of the company, if we make a set of tools that aren't available to everybody and aren't consumable by everybody, we feel that we sort of missed it on our mission. Back to another point. We can deliver this even with our native codecs. We have native codecs that perform beyond the capacity of anything that anybody's capable of or anybody's experienced in market with a fraction of the footprint.
Just want to make one thing clear about our codecs. They're oriented to high quality. We do not mess with the 28 kilobit sounds horrible stuff. That's just not our thing.
But still, we have stuff that, you know, with next-gen audio experiences can still be delivered over a 3G network without too much sweat.
It's not we have no trouble delivering things. Let's just leave it at that.
What is the ear of Sauron?
I love that
question. Well, I'll answer it. It is a funny-looking thing built for the purpose of measuring HRTFs.
Okay.
That's it in a nutshell. It means that you don't have to sit still for very long. You can make rapid measurements, and you can make them between the quietness of the room and everything else far more accurately than we needed. But it's much easier to deal with something too accurate than it is to deal with a ton of noise.
Yeah. Wow.
When we were making it, it was sitting across the warehouse, and there's one of the pieces looked like a giant eye on the ground, and one of our guys, hey, so you're making a big eye of Sauron? And someone said, oh, it's more of an ear. And it just kind of stuck. That it was so stupid that the name stuck as we called the thing. So even as you walk into the test lab, there's a giant eye of Sauron poster as you walk into the test room. It was fun. And it, you know.
It did its job.
JJ, I have a question for you. A little off the subject about Bell Labs. When I was growing up, Bell Labs was like the epitome of engineering excellence.
I wouldn't argue with that.
Yeah, I'm sure you wouldn't. And what happened?
I'm sorry, three words, the parent company. When it was taken over by accountants who wanted to do three months, they couldn't show return on research. And then when research, and sometimes development, it's not just research had the problem, came up with new things that might have been disruptive. Oh no. Can't disrupt our basic market.
That's not part of our core business.
Yes. Did you ever hear of A to B music?
No.
Jim, you want to tell them about it, Jim?
Oh, please. I think you're far better situated since you were in the picture with your colleagues from A to B Music recently.
Okay, well.
Well, a long time ago, but reposted recently.
Yes. 1997, we had servers in the basement, people, artists who would put up tracks and the ability to sell them for 99 cents a piece to download to your computer. We had, not in production, but we had about 100 prototypes of a player the size of a bit collider. Does it sound like a familiar service?
Sure does. Yeah. Wow.
Now, what happened is very simple. AT&T marketing decided, and I quote, "No one will ever sell music over the internet."
Wow.
Look, it's not too dissimilar to their other industrial peers. I mean, what happened with Kodak at the dawn of digital photography, even though they owned a lot of the IP rights around digital photography, they missed it.
Yeah.
I was on the committee. I was on, before MPEG separated, I was a separate committee. I was on the committee with those guys. They were trying to kill digital photography. I mean, but that's what happened. I mean, I don't know what to tell you. In 2002, they said, okay, you're retired, go away. At this point, well, Lucent failed mostly failed in 2001. There's still a little bit left. AT&T shut down 40% of research in 2002, and they're down to about 10% of what they had. And nobody does any basic research except for data mining.
Wow. It's a real shame. It's a national treasure.
Well, you know, IBM, you know, Xerox PARC, poof.
Yeah.
IBM, it's still there. Kodak, poof. Xerox, poof.
Yeah.
You know, and then people say, well, the universities are making up for the space. Nope. You can't do something. And I know this is something that I think modern business do not understand. You can't necessarily do something in 4 years.
Okay.
You know, you do need people. I mean, we've used up all of our basic research effectively in the US. And now the basic research, you know, it's like eating your seed corn. Yes, that's a sore point. Sorry. Mm. Yeah, I'm a researcher. I mean, when the reason that perceptual codecs came about is because I needed to write a really complicated test program for a computer. And I said, this might work.
I've never heard that. That's fantastic.
That's how PXFM came into existence.
All right. Let's get back to immersion for a second. Speaking of long term, so you started in 2015 and there's only something coming to market now. So that's a long run up there. You're obviously well funded.
Yeah, we wanted to get things right before we put anything in market. And also, it was the philosophy of places like a functioning Bell Labs that informed the way that we and our very patient investors configured the company at launch. But, you know, we identified to the pool of investors who did the initial backing, and we've brought in subsequent investors since, that this is a long process and that we're in the process of delivering a functioning platform that has a lot of other points that we're not going to speak about today, but that literally covers everything from create, capture, convert, and deliver and playback audio at all points in between. So we're fortunate in that we're gifted with some investors who got it, who understood that audio had been the subject of chronic underinvestment over the last 2-3 decades, and saw an opportunity for change.
I was just going to say that my experience has always been as audio comes last until you don't have any.
It's you guys, you've been around a long time. How come we're just hearing about you now? And the answer is simple, because we have patient investors who knew that for us to do what we needed to do, we needed to have things right and sounding and, you know, researched and developed first rather than developing a half-ass version of it in a mobile app and spitting it out and trying to find a business of it. It's kind of almost the inverse of the lean startup mentality that a lot of companies use today. And back to, just think about this, since the dawn of the iPhone, we've gone through 262, 263, 264. We've gone from 525 lines to 1080p to 4K to now heading towards 8K. And with audio, well, we have Wave, We have AAC, thanks to JJ. We have the MP3 file. But, you know, we haven't seen the kind of investment in audio in most of the companies, the other legacy companies. And this is where we found a real opportunity to play in the marketplace. Most of the audio research companies are more like pharma companies. They're more interested in extending the life of their IP than actually doing any real research and development.
It seems like you're focusing on headphones, earpieces, whatever the case, rather than speakers, although I know that's not entirely the case. But it brings up a point when it comes to research as well. You know, loudspeakers are the same as they've been for more than 100 years, and there hasn't been a real revolution there. There's been evolution, but there hasn't been a change.
They're the worst part of the system.
Yeah, and I always thought that we weren't going to have true immersive audio until that changed, until we got something new, a new technology that changed all that.
I will sort of take that, but we have to wait for a response from the patent office.
Okay.
Enough said. I mean, there is some stuff out there that talked about direct versus indirect radiation. That's one of the things that's missing pretty much in all of the concept of loudspeaker systems. You know, you have things like Floyd Till has written a lot about radiation patterns and so on. But the question is what does a loudspeaker look like? It generally looks like a point source or sometimes a dipole. If you're talking about a magnet panel, it's a dipole. But that's not what comes actually to your head from a listening area. And more than that, I'm not really willing to say right now.
Yeah,
I'm
okay.
Sorry.
But I tell you, Bobby, this is kind of like one of those things where someday we'll find a way to get you up here so you can experience some stuff. And I will just tell you that every day you walk around this building, there's another OMG moment. What the hell is that? And they're lurking all through here.
Not all good, but such is life.
Yeah, there's that.
Are you at liberty to say how big your team is?
I will say that we are relatively small and compact. We're fewer than 25.
And it's all research for the most part?
Research, coding, and a small business layer. So separating research from coding, right? So let me draw the distinction. Researchers, the people actually doing the science in creating the core inventions, and coders, the people turning it into executable applications in computer code. One interesting thing is that we found that coders that had experience, and Paul can speak to this probably better than me, coders that had experience in the video gaming industry tended to be more malleable than engineers who had come out of just audio processing, because we were working with things on an order of magnitude beyond what any of the audio people had ever experienced or encountered.
Yes.
The math is very different, right?
You know, the math is different than video, but the video people are willing to digest it. I won't name names or anything, but my experience in some previous locations has been questions like, but that's not how he did it last week. Like, yeah, I know that.
There's a lot of the...
JD and I have had a long history of trying to find programmers that get, you know, how the deep math you really need to understand perceptual side of this stuff. And luckily we've built a great core, and our first hire, our CTO, came from a video game background, and his speed in which he got the concepts, we just had to change some of the definitions. And then he was able to, you know, oh, I've been doing it this way. We really just had to teach him a different vocabulary, but he's already had been doing a bunch of things very similar in three-dimensional video related stuff. So we were able to build a team around that key insight very early. So that's been very helpful.
Same thing though, because if he's working in three-dimensional video, you're talking about multi-dimensional audio. Conceptually, it'd be the same.
That's actually a very good point. When I say R, theta, phi, they actually nod.
You guys make me excited for the audio industry. And that hasn't happened in a long time because, like I say, everything just seems like it's the same, as you mentioned, the same as it's always been done, only maybe a tad better. And after a while, it's so boring, and it gives me hope that there's new things to look forward to.
and quoting the words of my brother, who's been in the MI business for 45 years, same dog in a new dress.
Yeah. Yeah. There you go. This has been great. Is there anything I didn't ask you that you think is important?
You haven't asked us for your login for MixCubed, which Paul will send you.
No, I think I have one, actually.
Yeah. Okay.
I just have not taken advantage of it. I was early in on it.
I think you'll find it really illustrating when you play with this, and I'm going to invite you to kick the tires, hit us with questions, and then come back in about 2 more weeks for another release.
Okay, you're on. You're on to be good. Okay, my last question. This is my standard question to everybody, and if anyone is capable of answering this with some acuity and clarity, it's you guys. What's the best piece of business advice that you either learned along the way or maybe somebody imparted to you?
Paul, JJ, you guys can go first. I'll take last.
I think that stick with your gut and persistence has always been, the things that I've been taught early on, that trust your instinct. If you're going to, build what you really want to build. I mean, that's the, don't build what you think people want. Build what, you think they need. I think that's a key thing, is not to try and, modify something else. You build something that hasn't been done, and question everything is really we don't assume anything is correct. Is this filter correct? Is this, so many of those things were, a lesson in, if something's wrong in a system, try and find out where it's coming from, because you shouldn't accept that there's something, well, that's just how it is. I think that should be our mantra.
I just throw in the mention that Paul is the one of the three of us who was hired directly by Steve Jobs as a teenager, which is an interesting story for a follow-up later, Bobby.
No kidding.
Very Jobsian sort of, Paul's very Jobsian take has really instructed the culture of this place.
He was an incredible person to work with, and, many lessons from him, I would suppose, yeah.
JJ, did you take a shot at that answer?
I gave it the 10-foot pole, but my advice to people who have a business and want to keep it going is, don't fear disruption. Somebody's going to do it. And, and trying to concentrate on their product for the last 20 years. I mean, unless it's, something basic like creating lumber, you're probably not going to survive. So yes, you have to support your core business, but you always need to find new ones.
Jim.
It's listen before responding, take a pause and give it a thought.
You brought up one other thing, if I can mention it. You will hear various people, especially some of the established people, say, I tried their stuff and it doesn't do XX. And for a variety of XX that correspond to, quote, the way you're supposed to do everything. And there's a reason for that, because it really isn't the way you're supposed to do everything. You will hear that.
You can find out more about Immersion Networks and get a free 30-day trial subscription at immersion.net. That's immersion.net. Thanks for listening and being in my inner circle. Remember, if you have any questions or comments, you can send them to questions@bobbyosinski.com. To listen to other episodes of Bobby Osinski's Inner Circle, go to bobbyosinski.com and select the podcast tab, or go to bobbyoinnercircle.com, or you can find it on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, Mixcloud, Google Podcasts, Spotify, Deezer, TuneIn Radio, Radio Public, and Podbean. At bobbyosinski.com and bobbyoinnercircle.com, you'll also find a sign-up form for my newsletter for alerts for new podcasts. This is Bobby Osinski. I will see you next time.